Hi, thank you very much for joining us today for our webinar on legal issues for SaaS companies. There are a number of issues that are critical when you're moving from on-premise to the cloud, so I'm very glad that you're logging in today, because these are going to be important to you and you really do need to understand what the impact will be on your organization. I've been working with ISVs for more than 20 years, helping them develop the right go-to-market strategy for their solution. I've worked with ISVs from all over the world with all different types of platforms and have gained a very good understanding of what the business model implications are when we move from one technology base to another. We've been partnering with Microsoft since 2006 and we worked with a lot of their ISVs. And over the last 4 or 5 years, we've been focusing our time and attention on the business model issues that are relevant when you're moving from on-prem to the cloud. And one of the key issues is legal issues. This is the last of a series of 6 webinars. If you haven't watched the other ones, don't worry about it. You can go back and pick them up from the beginning. They're all available online. I would encourage you, if it's possible, to watch them in sequence, but it's not absolutely critical. At the end of the session, there will be a live Q&A. This is obviously a taped session, but I'm also logged in and I will be available to answer your questions. So bear with me as we go through the legal issues. Save up your questions and I will address them as you post them at the end of the session. So the agenda today, and I'm glad that you're sticking around for this, because legal issues can be a bit of a snoozer, but they can have a very, very big impact on your organization. So the things that we're going to talk about today, we're going to talk about, do you actually need a EULA, an end user license agreement? What happens when you terminate resellers, and why is the cloud different from on-premise? We'll go into some detail on service level agreements, because that's one of the things that you have with cloud that you don't run into very often with on-premise. We're going to talk about cyber liability insurance, Safe Harbor, which is a treaty between the US and Europe on how to treat and handle personal information. And finally, I'll talk a little bit about the Patriot Act, which is it's a real barrier to adoption of SaaS in Europe. It's something that if you're sitting in this call from outside of the US, you're very familiar with the Patriot Act. If you're a US company, you may not understand the implications. Just a quick disclaimer, we're not a legal firm, I'm not an attorney, we are not providing you with legal advice. We are talking about legal issues from a business perspective and providing you with some guidance. And when you look into these things in more detail, we definitely recommend that you talk to your own attorney to make sure that you get this handled correctly. So do you need a EULA? And for those of you that aren't familiar with the acronym, a EULA is an end user license agreement. This is the agreement that governs the rights that the customer has to use your software, the terms and conditions for the use of your software. If you are doing this as a pure multi-tenant SaaS application, you technically do not need an end user license agreement because you are not transferring the right to use the product. You are now provisioning a service. A service agreement tends to be a little bit less onerous, a little bit easier to negotiate than an end user license agreement. There are a couple of exceptions. If you are doing this as a hosted model, an ASP or VM model, then yes, there is a license. There's a license attached to each instance that you spin up, and you'll still need a EULA with your customers. Now, if you have a multi-tenant pure SaaS application, but there is a download, there's some piece of client software that goes on the desktop, you will still need a EULA. So the situations that don't require that, where you can get away with a services agreement, would be pure SaaS, multi-tenant, no downloads onto the customer desktop at all. Now let's look at what happens when you have resellers that are selling your applications, because there are a number of issues that come up that are very specific to the cloud. First of all, how do you transition the billing? This is not really an issue if you have been selling on-prem, but if the customer's been doing the billing, and in many cases in the enterprise space, if the VARs are responsible for doing the sales, the marketing, they will want to own the client relationship. If they have been doing the billing and the agreement gets terminated for whatever reason, you need to have a provision in your contract that allows you to step in, take over the relationship with the end user, and start doing the billing. The last thing that you want is to have a very unhappy, dissatisfied partner collecting money on your behalf and holding on to it. Now, the second part of that is, do they continue to get paid? Think about this when you're selling on-premise. They've sold a license for $100,000, they've collected the money from their customer, they've kept their discount of $40,000, they've remitted $60,000 to you, everyone's happy. more or less happy. The partners collected their $40,000. The money is sitting in their bank. If they get terminated, they still have the money they earned for selling the license. If this is a SaaS license, so if they've gone out and they've made 6 sales, they're expecting to collect their discount on a monthly basis over the next 3, 4, 5 years, and they get terminated for whatever reason, they don't get paid the compensation that they expect. This is an issue that will come up. We haven't seen it come up yet, but it will come up in the courts, where the vendor has terminated a partner that has all kinds of recurring revenue that they've built up, and they've terminated the contract, and the partner feels that they are being cheated out of the compensation that they so richly deserve for having created that revenue stream for the vendor. What we suggest is that you build in a termination clause and a termination fee in the contract up front. It's a lot easier to negotiate this up front than it is after the fact. And the termination fee could simply be that they get 50% of their normal discount for a period of 12 months so that it tapers off and you don't have to pay them on a perpetual basis. Now, another issue that can come up is, has the partner been hosting the solution? Now, this won't be the case if this is an Azure multi-tenant. That's not an option for the partner, not today. But if this is an ASP model where you have a .NET, for various reasons, you may have given the partner permission to host your application. Where we see this sometimes is in jurisdictions in the Middle East, for example, where a hosted application has to sit on a data center. In Kuwait, for example, a hosted solution has to be hosted in Kuwait. So you may be looking at a situation where if you want to get into a market, local legislation requires that that application sits on a data center in that particular geography. What happens then? Our suggestion is, unless you know that partner really well, and you're very certain about their integrity, that you just don't go there, that you give up that market opportunity. If you have a partner that is hosting the solution and they're responsible for collecting the money on your behalf, you have almost no leverage other than suing them, and then you have to sue them in their jurisdiction. You have very little leverage to get your product back or to collect the money that you might be due. It's a very difficult situation to get into. And then who's going to support the customizations that are done if the partners are allowed to do the customizations? We talked earlier about using your product as a platform that makes it easy for a partner ecosystem to build add-ons, extensions, new applications that sit on top of your product. Not really an issue with on-premise. We see this with Dynamics is a very good example. Dynamics ERP systems are a platform where the whole strategy is to have ISVs that can build vertical market applications, extensions, and add-ons on top of Dynamics. Now, if that partner gets terminated, they've been gone for a couple of years, and there's a new version of the product that breaks the code, breaks the link, the APIs with those add-ons, the customer can still use the product. It's on their desktop. They may have to wait a while before they get an update, but it doesn't stop their business. Now, think about that situation if you're in a cloud environment, and you have partners that have built these applications, extensions, front-end applications that have been used by the customer, and you terminated the partner 2 years ago for whatever reason, and you come out with a new code base that brings all of those links. The customer could be coming into work one morning, logging on, and nothing works because they're logging on through someone else's application. That application is no longer integrated with your platform. There are going to be some legal issues that come up because of that. So there are things that you can do to protect yourself. One is that you have standard SDK software development toolkits that you make available to your partners that they have to comply with. And you can have certification so that at any given time, an application has to be certified by you to work on your product. The other is that you can mandate that your partners put their source code into an escrow account that would only be made available to you if, number one, the agreement has been terminated, and number two, you come out with a new code base that breaks the links. That way, you can go in and fix all of the links with all of the add-ons and applications and make sure that your customers, the end users, have a smooth transition to the new product. Now let's talk a little bit about service level agreements, which are typically very specific to the cloud. There are 4 basic elements of this, and I'll go into each one of these in a little bit more detail, but one is control. That's the vendor control versus internal control. What do you control? What do they control? Operational risks, perceived risks around security, privacy, and data ownership. Business risk, those are the performance guarantees, uptime, availability, response times. And then penalties, rewards, and transparency. These are the types of things that should be built into an SLA. These are the types of things that your customers are going to be concerned about. So to the extent that you can address these upfront and build them into the contract, it avoids a lot of discussion when it gets time to negotiate the contract. So let's look at control. What this means is system availability. Now, this is how much time, what's the downtime? Are you promising 99.5, 99.9, 5 nines? What is the amount of uptime that you're guaranteeing? System response time. This can be latency. We talked earlier in an earlier webinar that if you're in a selling into a market that's fairly remote from the data center, the response time could be beyond what is acceptable to the customer. And then what happens if there's if you have a failover? What happens if a system goes down? One of the beauties of Microsoft Azure is that it has built-in redundancy, and you can also have geo-redundancy, so if something catastrophic happens to the data center in Dublin, then everything would still be available on the data center in Amsterdam. The operational risk, I'll just go through these things fairly quickly. This legalese, these are just checklist items that you should be thinking about, things that your customers are probably going to ask you about. So will they get their data back if they leave? How easy do you make it for them to migrate to a new application? Do you charge them for that as a fee-based service? What's your data retention policy? You should have this written down that if a customer leaves or if the contract is terminated, then you agree to retain their data for 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. And this will also be governed by local jurisdictions. There are countries that mandate some minimum retention period. So in each of those markets, if you're operating internationally, you need to be aware of what that local regulation is. What happens if there's a privacy breach? And we're going to talk about this when we talk about cyber liability insurance, but who's responsible? And then do you undertake PCI, SAS 70 type audits? These are all security related. One of the things about downtime is, well, you can say that we're just going to piggyback our SLA on Microsoft's SLA because we are on Azure. So if we're getting 3 nines from Microsoft, we'll guarantee 3 nines to our customers. And if something happens, we'll get compensated by Microsoft. Yes, you will. But you'll be compensated by Microsoft for the economic value of their service to you. Now, when you're selling your application and your service downstream to your customer, it has a completely different value component. So you may be paying $100 in Azure consumption to Microsoft, and you get some percentage of that back because there was some downtime, but you might be selling a $10,000 service to your customer. So the value of the interruption service to your customer is going to be orders of magnitude higher than the value of the interruption that you're getting from Microsoft. So there is going to be an economic penalty for you that you have to be aware of. Okay, the business risk. Error resolution, I get this with the on-premise as well. How quickly are you going to fix something that isn't working the way it's supposed to? Timeliness and quality of professional services. Are you providing professional services? Are you doing customization? Are you doing integration? All of that needs to be built into the contract. And then proactive communications. We've emphasized this in several of the modules. SaaS is a communications platform. You have to have ongoing communications. If there are issues, products, problems, or if there are going to be updates or new features, make sure that your customer knows about it. Customers like to see that there's a process of continuous improvement, that there are going to be new features, functionality, and that what they can expect. If there's this black hole of communication, they don't think anything's happening, and they see something else that some other vendor is selling, the new shiny object, they may be willing to move to that vendor. Penalties, rewards, and transparency. I mentioned this earlier, just be very open with your customer about everything. Document how penalties and rewards are going to be calculated. Automatic credit or refund upon request. Do you automatically, proactively notify your customer that something happened and that they've earned some type of a penalty, some type of an offset, or are you going to wait for your customers to call you and complain? Much better to be proactive and then make sure that they're being treated properly. Okay, so just a quick summary of SLAs. Define the metrics that's being measured. If it's uptime, for example, if it's 3 nines uptime, is that being measured on a monthly, quarterly, or annual basis? That has a big impact on you. The longer the term, the better, because you can get some very significant swings and variations on a short-term basis. 1 hour of downtime in a month has a much bigger impact on you and the customer in terms of percentage performance than 1 hour of downtime in a year. Are there any exclusions to performance? So for example, are there things that you have scheduled downtime for maintenance, for upgrades? Are there things that you take out of the calculation for downtime on the SLA? And then what are your support hours? This just needs to be published. Is it 9 to 5? Is it 24/7? Just need to publish what those hours are. And then finally, if something does happen and your customers have they should be getting some type of a credit, how do you issue that? Do you write them a check, or do you use this as a credit against the next month? Usually the best thing for everybody, the simplest thing, is just to apply the refund as a credit against the next month's payment, and it's an automatic adjustment. So you don't have to go through the paper hassle of issuing a check, making a payment. And finally, the liability levels for confidentiality breaches. This has become a very big issue recently. You've probably seen this in the news. But this is covered by cyber liability insurance. And you might be shaking your head saying, cyber what? Yep, you need cyber liability insurance to cover you in the event of a breach, because those breaches can be expensive. We've seen in the news lately, very recently, Target, now Neiman Marcus, and we had Adobe, TJ Maxx, Sony, these huge privacy breaches, and it costs a lot to rectify that. Now, those were on massive scales. So when you have someone like Target with 110 million records that have to be fixed, that's going to be a very, very expensive proposition for them. But industry-wide, the average expense of one of these privacy breaches is $7.2 million per incident. It costs roughly $200 per record. Now, that's notifying the customer, maybe notifying them several times, fixing the problem, some small amount of compensation. That number, the 7.2, continues to grow because more and more data is being stored in data centers. So each one of these massive situations like we had with Sony and with Adobe and with Target will continue to drive up that average cost. But you should definitely be talking to an insurance agent. Most major insurance companies now provide this because it's not enough to rely on Microsoft. So you say, well, I'm on Azure. Azure's a secure platform. They've got all the security built into it. Microsoft will protect me. It's not their responsibility. It's your application. It's your login security. It's your responsibility. Yes, Microsoft is responsible for Azure as the underlying platform, but you've got your application sitting on top of Azure. You've got your own login. It's up to you to protect your customer and the data that you're storing in your application. Talk a little bit about a couple of international things. This is more for US companies. There is something called the Safe Harbor Treaty between the US and Europe. Europe has very strict privacy laws, and what they do is make it very difficult. They don't want European data to be stored anywhere else. So in most jurisdictions in Europe, there is a law that says that private information, personally identifiable information on a French citizen or German citizen, cannot be stored outside of the European Union. Of course, that makes it very difficult to run a SaaS application from the US. So as a way of getting around this, and this was actually taken care of in 1996 during the ASP blip, they set up the Safe Harbor provisions. And the Safe Harbor provisions allows US companies to store European personal information in the United States as long as they meet certain requirements. And it's not that difficult to get it set up. You just need to register your compliance with the Department of Commerce. You publish a Safe Harbor notice on your website. There are 7 provisions that you need to comply with, and I'll outline those in the next couple of slides. And then be prepared to be audited, because you are stating that you are complying with these provisions, and the European Union theoretically can come in and audit you to make sure that you are in compliance. But if you do, then you are okay under Safe Harbor, and you can store European personal information in the United States. Now, if you're sitting there as an ISV in Australia or South Africa, the Safe Harbor provision doesn't help you. It makes it very difficult for you to sell a subscription into Europe if the data is going to be stored on your data center outside of Europe. So the 7 provisions that you need to comply with, the first is notice. You need to tell people, individuals that you're collecting and storing information, you need to notify them. You have to give individuals the opportunity to opt out. You are limited in your ability to forward information to other third parties. Those third parties also have to be in compliance, and you have to have the opt-out ability for the end user, the individual. Individuals need to be given access to the information to make sure that they can correct anything that is incorrect. this is where security comes in, and one of the benefits of Microsoft's Azure is that it complies with all of the security provisions for just about every jurisdiction and for the different vertical markets like healthcare and retail. The data integrity means that you agree to keep accurate information and that you only use information for the purpose that it was intended to be used for, so that you're not collecting extra information that you're planning to sell off. Whatever information that you're collecting has to be very relevant to the application and the requirements of the application. And then finally, it needs to be enforceable. This is something where the audit comes in. Now, the Patriot Act. This is something that is a very emotional issue in Europe. The Patriot Act is different from Safe Harbor. The Patriot Act is, in theory, the United States government has the right to access personal information on non-US citizens wherever that information is, if that information is stored on a data center that's owned by a US company or the subsidiary of a US company. That means Amazon, it means Google, it means Microsoft. Even though the Microsoft data center might be in Amsterdam, it's owned by a US corporation, and in theory, it gives the US government the right to access personal information on Dutch citizens if that data is stored on Azure. That scares the daylights out of people in Europe. And there are jurisdictions like France and Germany where they're using this actively to fight the encroachment, what they feel is the encroachment of American data centers into Europe. It's a very emotional issue. The reality is that it's very difficult for the US government to legally get that information. They have to get a subpoena in the United States explaining and justifying why they want information on an individual. If they get that subpoena in the US, they have to go to Holland and get that same subpoena from the Dutch legal system before they can access that information. But it is a very emotional issue, and it's been one of the barriers to adoption of SaaS in Europe. We talked about the China when we looked at the different geographies and the geographic markets, so I'll just quickly go through this if you've seen that already. But China is almost a non-starter for most non-Chinese SaaS companies. It is heavily regulated as a telecom service. You need to have a local telecoms license, which can take a year to get. And it needs to be a local joint venture or a Chinese entity that actually goes through the process. So in order to comply with this, you have to find a partner, set up a new company. That company has to be at least 50% owned by a local Chinese entity, and then that entity goes in to get the license from the Chinese government. But this is one of the things that makes Microsoft the right choice as a platform. Windows Azure loves local data centers. If you look at the Microsoft strategy and where they're moving, Windows Azure will be the operating system for data centers. There will be at some point in the future, in the next 2 to 3 years, where people will be able to run Azure as a private cloud. What this means for you as an ISV is that you can go to Germany and you can give the customer whatever choice they want. Do they want Azure on-premise? Is it a German customer that is very concerned about having their data sitting on a Microsoft data center because of the Patriot Act? Then they would be able to run an Azure application on their own data center because Windows Server will be Windows Azure. It may cost them more, but that's a decision that they make, a business decision. You can sell them as a subscription service, a typical monthly whatever subscription model as a public cloud, or it can be a hybrid where they're running a core application and storing personal information on their data center, and they're using Azure for the extra, for the spikes, the excess usage, the excess in usage on a monthly basis. So what this means is that as Azure moves forward, you as an ISV will be able to pursue any business model that's right for you, any business model that's in the best interest of your customer. So very quickly, I want to talk about the SaaS business modeling tool. This is an online modeling tool that Microsoft has developed and is making available only to Microsoft ISVs. It is a very comprehensive modeling tool that allows you to go in and look at every aspect of your business as you're transitioning from on-prem to the cloud. You can look at your pricing, Azure consumption, look at your customer segmentation. You can build out your go-to-market strategy and assign costs to every step of it. Sales, marketing, whether you're doing fully automated, going through telesales, going through inside sales, going through channels. You can build in your growth rates, assumptions for churn. All of this feeds into a 4-year monthly P&L. And then you can play with the assumptions. You can change the assumptions. You can see, well, what happens if we increase our price by 25%? What happens if we change our go-to-market strategy from direct sales to a channel or to inside sales or to an SEO-based model? All of that will then be reflected immediately in the P&L. The tool is being made available through a tutorial with us. It is a comprehensive tool, so it's not designed for self-service. But if you sign up for a 3-hour tutorial with us, we'll take you through every aspect of the model. You'll be assigned your own login. We can feed in your data, go through the model, and focus on the issues and elements that are relevant to you. And then you'll have a working model that you can play with moving forward. To do this, you just sign up on our website. On our homepage, there will be a graphic in the bottom right-hand corner. Click on that, and that'll take you through to the registration page. Finally, just again, want to remind you that this is a series of 6 webinars. We would encourage you, to the extent possible, to watch them in the right sequence, but it's not absolutely critical to do so. Here's my contact information. Feel free to send me an email, call me. If you have any kind of a question that I can help you with, very happy to do so. And for those of you that are logging on real time and watching this, I am now available for your questions. So please populate the fields, the little window with your questions, and I will answer them as we move forward here. Thank you very much for your time today.